Welcome to Future of Journalism, a podcast from the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at the University of Oxford. I'm Federica Cherubini, Director of Leadership Programs at the Institute. This is a special series of our podcast, and it's dedicated to the Digital News Report 2024. Over six episodes, we are diving into the most comprehensive piece of research on news consumption around the world. This is a 13th edition of the report and is based on data from six continents and 47 markets, making this the largest report we have ever published. In this episode of the series, we're joined by lead author of the report, Nick Newman, and director of the Reuters Institute and co-author of the report, Rasmus Nielsen. There is no shortage of challenges and uncertainty around how information environments might look like in just a few years. In a year of wars and elections, we are seeing substantive changes happening in the news ecosystem. Some big tech companies are explicitly deprioritizing news and political content, while other platforms switch their focus on engaging creators and influencers and pushing entertaining formats like videos. This platform reset is making a reliance on links to drive referral traffic news publishers more uncertain. And on the other end, fast advances of generative AI can potentially even further disrupt the link ecosystem with AI-driven search, for example. So this year, the Digital News Report looked at these issues, but also much more, things like the different levels of confidence people have in their ability to distinguish between trustworthy and untrustworthy content across different platforms, as well as people's attitudes towards the use of AI in news. So in this episode, we'll ask Nick and Rasmus to help unpack some of these issues. Nick, Rasmus, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So Nick, in the report, you use this phrase, platform reset, to describe much of the change that we are seeing in large areas of online news consumption. What is this platform reset and how it is impacting news consumption?
Well, I think in the time we've been doing the Digital News Report, we've seen platforms becoming ever more important parts of the ecosystem in terms of what news, what brands people get exposed to. What we're really talking about here is some quite fundamental changes in strategy by a number of the big tech players. And that's partly driven by AI. You've talked about that already, partly by changing audience behaviors and just greater competition for eyeballs and attention between, many more platforms. So, you know, it used to be mainly Facebook or Google and or primarily, but it's a much wider range now. And how's that affecting news? Well, I think the biggest impact that we see in our data this year is very significant declines in the use of Facebook for news, but also X or Twitter, as previously called. Facebook use overall down 4 percentage points on average across countries, but in some places 10 or 11 points, and it was similar a year ago. And this, of course, is partly because Facebook themselves have deliberately changed their strategies. They're promoting publisher content less and investing in content that they consider to be more engaging and also in formats that are more engaging. You've talked about video already. So in a nutshell, referrals from social media, which has been such a huge driver of traffic, economically sustaining many news sites, that's beginning to dry up. And at the same time, we have this preference for newer formats that are designed to keep attention within those platforms rather than linking out to websites as they might have done in the past. And in combination, that is putting a lot of strain on the bottom line for many publishers.
The report covers many platforms. Which are the big winners and losers when it comes to news consumption? And does this vary across different markets?
It does a bit, but I've mentioned already sort of the platform that's been most affected. So that's Facebook. But there are growth areas, and that's primarily in these video first platforms like YouTube and TikTok, as well as video-heavy platforms like Instagram. But we're also seeing, that fragmentation. So closed messaging apps such as WhatsApp, Telegram also growing in many parts of the world. Aggregators too. I mean, in Apple News, for example, has become steadily more important in the market. I would pick out TikTok partly because it's growing fastest in many markets, particularly in markets in the global south. So in some around half of our samples say that they use TikTok for any purpose, about a third for news now. So that's quite a big change. And indeed, it's played a significant role in a number of the elections around the world this year. Argentina, Indonesia, for example, politicians really using that network to connect with young people. So some of this is really consequential.
Rasmus, can I bring you in on these consequences for publishers? What does this situation mean for publishers?
Well, I mean, I think it's really important that publishers are realistic about the way in which the media ecosystem is changing and recognize very clearly that, as Nick rightly stressed, throughout all the years that we've done the Digital News Report, we see this ongoing shift away from direct discovery towards distributed forms of discovery. The public is increasingly relying on competing platforms to access all sorts of content and information. And it's important to recognize that it's in a context where much of the public is very skeptical of the quality and integrity of some of that information. Much of the public is concerned about how some of these companies have been very blasé about the level of misinformation and hate speech and other kinds of disgusting material that has spread across their products and services, and where many have reservations about their data collection practices and approaches to privacy and many other issues. At the same time, people continue to engage with them. And as, for example, the Knight Foundation and others have documented in their research, they do so in part because they say that they find them useful in terms of getting access to more relevant and useful information. They find that they help them connect with people like them. They find that they make it easier for people like them to express themselves and share their own points of view. So the shift is very clear, and we have seen no substantial examples of any travel in the opposite direction. Now, the thing that's happened in the last couple of years, in addition to the sort of increasing prominence of video and visuals that Nick mentioned, and the sort of shift towards a greater emphasis on on-site content that in turn leads to fewer referrals and a greater prominence of more private and closed environments, whether private groups or messaging applications, is that many of these platforms are turning away from news and publishers and instead focusing more on other kinds of content and other creators where perhaps the complementarity is more obvious and there is less friction, in part because the other creators are not organized or unionized often. So they are essentially sort of atomized and easier to deal with for platforms. And I think we need to be very clear. This is a more complicated platform ecosystem for publishers to navigate. It's one in which the mass referrals that we saw for a period of time are drying up in most cases. It's one in which there is growing competition for attention. And it all means that journalists and publishers have to work much, much harder to earn the public's attention, merit being a regular part of their daily habits and daily lives, let alone a meaningful one. And of course, all of that is a premise, really, for convincing anyone to pay for news. So it's a much harder battle for attention. It's a much harder battle for being part of people's daily routines. And it's also going to be very tough to make a compelling case for people to pay for news content in a world where many of them feel that much of what they need is provided in more compelling and convenient ways by others, often for free.
Nick, we mentioned the fragmentation of multiple platforms and shifts, but are we continuing to see the growth of platform as the primary gateway to news?
I mean, that's been the story of the last 10 years. As Rasmus says, increasing use of social platforms, declining direct traffic. But I think, you know, resets mean there's more uncertainty, and in many cases, usage of traditional platforms is being challenged or replaced by some of these alternative ones. So I think it's much more about this uncertainty, more fragmentation in consumption across platforms, and as Rasmus says, more challenging, more complicated for news publishers to reach different audiences.
Rasmus, another major theme in journalism over the past year has been generative AI, with Newsroom beginning to use it for different tasks internally or audience facing. Can you describe some of these ways in which we are seeing AI being used? And how do audiences feel about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think first it's important to highlight, as you know, Nick began to document in his Trends and Predictions report in January, and that Richard Fletcher has led on other work that we have done, and many other researchers have sort of brought to light similar data, that first of all, I think we need to recognize that while generative AI is much discussed and sometimes being integrated into very popular productivity software suites or search engines or social platforms that people routinely make use of, it's still early days in terms of the mass public adoption of standalone generative AI chatbots. You know, some people do use them, but most of those who use them are mostly playing around. They're not using them regularly. So it's still early days. That does not mean there won't be an impact or even potentially a quite a radical impact. I personally believe there probably will be, but it's also important to recognize these things don't happen overnight, as we know, right? The commercial internet and later search, later social media and mobile all had radical impacts, but the impacts didn't materialize in a year or two. In terms of what our research at this early stage says about how the public thinks about it, I think it's important that publishers and journalists draw some encouragement from the fact that our research suggests that generally the public wants humans in the loop when it comes to news. So even in a context where much of the public may have a pretty dim view of journalism, may not appreciate it that much, may not necessarily trust it, it's still the case that many see a distinct value add, a distinct important role. And generally we find many more people who say they're comfortable with getting news produced mainly by humans with some help from AI than say they prefer mainly AI with some human oversight. Now, it varies across different kinds of use cases, right? I mean, the industry is experimenting with these tools for all sorts of different purposes. We try to get a better understanding of what the public thinks of these different kinds of uses. There is generally greater acceptance of the sort of back-end, behind-the-scenes uses that many newsrooms have been experimenting with for some time, from really basic stuff like copy editing to things around how you do your marketing material or optimize your paywall strategy and whatnot. Not all of this relies on generative AI. There are other kinds of AI that publishers rely upon. We see some openness to use AI to deliver news in new ways. We've seen some publishers experiment with synthetic voices, synthetic presenters and anchors and the like, versioning of content, summary of content and the like, but much less acceptance of using AI to generate news content, in particular without robust human oversight.
You mentioned different ways of using AI. What about the topics? Are there some topics that people feel more comfortable with AI being involved in their production?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, again, it's an area where journalists and editors can perhaps draw some encouragement in the sense that generally the public is much more insistent on the importance of having a human in the loop and a sort of human-led editorial process on what many journalists and editors would think of as sort of quote-unquote hard news topics, politics, crime, where there are very real stakes, where it's really important that one gets the facts right and thinks through all the sort of qualitative judgments that have to be made about what one publishes and why. And then there is a much greater acceptance of integrating AI into news production on quote-unquote softer news topics, such as celebrity entertainment coverage or sports coverage. Now, of course, the challenge for publishers is that the latter things where people are much more accepting of the role of AI are not the most prestigious part of journalism, not the way in which publishers present themselves to the public as, you know, we do lots of this on celebrities, you know, come to us for celebrities and sports, but it's very important for the business. It's often a large part of traffic. It's often a large part of engagement. It's often a large part of what sort of built up routine usage. And in those areas, I think we'll see a lot of challenges to establish publishers, even as our data at this early stage suggests that the public still feels quite strongly that they would rather have journalists and editors make the decisions about how politics and crime is covered than have generative AI do so.
Nick, we mentioned in the opening some platforms are focusing more on influencers and creators, and Rasmus mentioned it. And indeed, in many years, we have seen journalists and commentators go directly to some of these platforms, leaving behind some of the most traditional, for example, TV channels, to speak directly to this online and platform-first audience. is this format having any success with audiences around the world, and which platforms are most popular?
Yeah, I think this trend is linked to what we talked about earlier, the change of strategies from platforms. So developing long-form video opportunities as well as short-form. So it's not just about short-form videos. So most famously, Tucker Carlson in the US, for example, forced out of Fox News, of course, set up his own network. He's generating very large audiences on X and other platforms. He had 200 million views for that interview with Vladimir Putin. But there are others as well. I mean, Megyn Kelly has been operating on YouTube for a long time, Don Lemon, moving from CNN. And in the UK, we have seen, significant figures like Piers Morgan, another well-known and often controversial host, taking his uncensored program online only. This is a bit of a trend. The other related trend is the visualization of podcasts. So many of these are now being filmed and distributed across multiple platforms. So this is another sort of factor pushing longer form video. But of course, as with all trends, a lot of people are piling in. There's a lot of content. One thing to get attention in the first place, much harder to keep it and to monetize it. And I think the jury's still out on that.
So there is a chapter in the report, and later in this podcast series, we'll dedicate a full episode at the whole range of influencers in a number of countries around the world. But for now, how are some of these news influencers trying to reach specifically younger audiences? And are they trying to fill any specific niche?
Absolutely. I mean, this year, for the first time, we asked survey respondents to identify some of the creators, some of the influencers they were paying attention to in social and video platforms. And it was really striking to find in many countries, sort of individuals, successful news creators, such as Hugo Decrypt, for example, in France, Jack Kelly, who runs a brand in the UK called TLDR, so sort of shorter news by young people for young people. Vita Spiha, who does a TikTok roundup in the US, again, very very widely cited in the United States. And these creators are really doing things a little bit differently. They're connecting with younger audiences across a whole range of genres, particular subjects or general news as well. And in some cases, like Decrypt, they're actually more successful than traditional brands on social media in total, according to our data, in terms of the number of citations.
Rasmus, a recurring theme in Digital News Report concerns audiences' perception about misinformation in online news. We're recording this podcast the day after the EU elections. We've seen some big elections happening in big countries already happening. More will come. Wars raging around the world. Concern about misinformation are perhaps or could be more significant in such a backdrop. Which news topics are the biggest source of misinformation according to our survey's respondents?
I mean, the answer in one word is politics. The bulk of public concern around online misinformation is about politics. By the way, this is sort of largely aligned with years of social science research that suggests that often misinformation is intertwined with politics and driven by some political actors who spread false misleading information for political purposes. Of course, there are other forms of misinformation as well, but this is a central one, and the public seems to recognize that. We have concern also on other sort of classic areas that often, frankly, intersect with the party politics as well. So perceptions of the economy, perceptions of public health issues, where, of course, the coronavirus pandemic has been a big one. And then, as you say, international political issues, where the war in Gaza and the war in Ukraine are both two areas that many respondents identify as topics where they are concerned that they come across examples of online misinformation. More broadly, the level of public worry about these issues keeps creeping up. It's 59% this year across the markets that we cover who say they're worried about what is real and what is fake on the internet when it comes to online news, up another 3 percentage points since last year. There is considerable variation from country to country. It's higher than the market average in India and South Africa, both of whom have recently had elections. It's also higher in the United States, which of course will have elections a few months from now. Now, I think publishers need to sort of think about these concerns, both in terms of making sure that they help citizens really understand the scale and scope of the misinformation problems that exist in different societies, which are very pronounced in some, but much less so in others. This is an important journalistic role. And I'm glad to see that this has become sort of the beat in some organizations. And there are examples of really good coverage of this, though, of course, as with every area, there is considerable variation. I also think that publishers have to think about that the fact that when people say they are concerned about misinformation, they often have in mind, in part, news coverage of politics. So that that when the public is very concerned about this, it's not that they are very concerned about online misinformation and therefore flocking to journalism. Often when people say they're concerned about online misinformation, they mean in part journalism, in particular political journalism. And I do think that publishers need to sort of think about what impact this widespread public concern has also for them, their own profession and their own industry.
Bringing this back to the point we made before about the fractured platform landscape, are there some social media platforms that can cause more concern among users when it comes to discerning what news is trustworthy or not?
I mean, absolutely, yes. I mean, we've known for years from our own research that just as the concern on topics and sources is centered on politics, the concern about platforms is centered on Facebook and secondarily on messaging applications, of which in most markets, the most important example is the Meta-owned WhatsApp. So in a sense, if the answer in one sense is politics, the answer in another sense is Meta is at the center of public concern. Now, this year, we asked some new questions that I think are gives another way of thinking about public perspectives on this, where we asked people about how easy they find it to tell apart trustworthy versus untrustworthy news and information on various platforms. The good news here is that on the most widely used platforms, a majority say they find it easy to tell the difference between trustworthy and untrustworthy news. And on all platforms included in our survey, a large plurality say so. Many more people say they find it easy than find it hard. So it ranges. There is some meaningful variation here. At the low end, you have, you know, X, the platform formerly known as Twitter and LinkedIn, where 41% say they find it easy to tell the difference between trustworthy and untrustworthy news, and then a higher 60% when it comes to Google search. If we sort of flip it around and look not just at the sort of broad-based sense in the public that people are concerned about online misinformation and they may be concerned about the impact this might have on other people, but they generally feel reasonably capable of navigating this on their own for their own purposes, that there are still some platforms where a much higher number of people say they find it difficult. Facebook, which I've already mentioned, is one of them. 21% say they find it difficult to tell the difference between trustworthy and untrustworthy news on Facebook. 24% on X and 27% on TikTok. And I think the latter is a particular concern, as TikTok is probably the most important and example of a newer platform that's really growing in popularity. And in that sense, it is concerning to see that there is less confidence from its user base about how to navigate information on this platform that more and more people use for many different purposes, but also sometimes for information about current affairs.
Sort of like a natural segue to this, but leaving aside the concern specifically around misinformation, if we turn to trust levels, what are the levels of trust in news like in general? And is there any variation across the world?
I guess that the sort of the good news here from the point of view of journalists and publishers is that it hasn't gotten worse. Across markets this year, 40% say they feel that they can trust most news most of the time. And there is a lot of variation across countries, just as there is a lot of variation across different brands within countries, where some are much less trusted than news in general, and others are much more highly and broadly trusted than news in general. Generally, if we look across countries, there are a lot of contextual factors that matter, and some idiosyncratic factors as well, of course. But generally, in relatively egalitarian, peaceful countries with diverse but not that polarized and antagonistic politics, trust tends to be higher. These are the Nordic countries, the Low Countries, parts of German-speaking Europe. The trust in news is generally lower in deeply unequal societies with deeper disagreement, where some political actors have made attacking the media part of their political strategy. You can think of the United States as a key example of this, but also France. And this kind of criticism we know matters. The more people come across criticism of the news media, whether online or offline, whether from politicians or others, that tends to influence their trust in news. And then there is a complex relationship here with media freedom as well. Trust is often lower in countries with low media freedom. Hungary is an example in Europe, but there are many across the world, even as this relationship gets much more complicated in more tightly controlled authoritarian contexts, where people may begin to think about the issue of trust somewhat differently and perhaps also be quite cautious with how they respond to questions around this.
Nick, Rasmus mentioned that, mostly positively, maybe we're going to look at it, trust levels have remained stable in many countries and have not gotten worse. Are audiences showing the same level of interest in news and how this varies across countries?
Yeah, I think the issues of engagement and engagement with particular groups is very much top of mind for publishers, and they see declining engagement in their data, and we see the same. So in countries like the UK, for example, we find that only around a third now say that they are interested or very interested in the news. And that was more like 70% in 2015. So it's almost half. This is what people say in surveys. We've also seen big falls in other large countries like France and Germany, US, and elsewhere. And of course, this is having an effect, a real effect, on the extent to which people are seeking out the news directly or even via social media. Now, we were hoping that this year, the elections would make a difference. It might reverse those trends. We have seen actually a bit of an uptick in some of the markets holding elections like the US, but nothing like, the Trump bump that we saw in 2016. And, I think that partly reflects the fact that for many people, people see politics as toxic rather than engaging in a way that they might have done in the past. And so, I think this sort of challenge of engagement is incredibly real right now.
So if interest in news is declining in some areas and in some countries, are we also seeing news avoidance level rising? And what are the biggest factors that seem to turn people away from the news?
Right. So apart from sort of interest in news, we also measure this concept of selective news avoidance. So these are people quite often who are interested in news, but who say that they often or sometimes avoid it. And that number is the highest on record in our survey. So 39% this year on average across all the markets, higher in some markets. And, some of this is kind of a natural reaction to the news agenda, which is pretty depressing. Let's face it, ongoing wars in the Middle East, in Ukraine. And respondents in our survey talk about needing to protect their mental health, the stress of being constantly bombarded with more and more news, with very little light, and about intractable conflicts or difficult issues like climate change that have no obvious way of no agency. People talk about not having any agency, being able to do anything about these really difficult, complex global issues. I think, the news industry in responding is very much aware of this. It's experimenting with a whole load of new approaches, such as constructive journalism, solutions journalism, providing more explainers to help explain these complicated issues. We talked about a lot of this last year. And this year, we're looking at trying to understand underlying user needs that audience have and how they may or may not be met by media companies. And I think there's a whole separate episode on that, but I think there's some interesting gaps which potentially the media can close here.
So if publishers might be worried about struggling to attract the attention of an engagement of audiences, even more those publishers who rely on some of their audiences to fund their journalism might be worried. In recent digital news reports, we saw a leveling off in the percentage of people who pay for online news after a modest rise throughout the COVID-19 pandemics. What changes are we seeing this year?
I mean, a few changes here and there, but for most publishers, it's a pretty static picture. It's a struggle, actually, to keep many of the existing subscribers or members, let alone find new ones. So our data suggests that the average across 20 countries where subscription models and membership models are widespread, 17% say they paid for any kind of online news in the last year. So the majority not paying. Quite a lot of variation. So in some of those Nordic countries with stronger direct connections, Norway, for example, 40%, Sweden, 33%. So payment is much higher. And it tends to be lower in countries where there's a lot more competition, a lot more free news, such as the United Kingdom, just 8%, for example. And the discussion amongst publishers right now is, you know, how to get growth going again and also how to reduce churn. So that is the proportion of people who are not renewing their subscription each year. And some of that has been exacerbated by the cost of living crisis, which means that people are just sort of shopping around a lot more around a whole range of subscriptions, not just media subscriptions, and comparing the value that they get out of each. And sometimes news doesn't come out very well in that equation.
So this year, you also looked at how much people are paying for the new subscriptions, and especially comparing full price versus different offers or discount. What did you find out?
Right. We asked people, this is the first time we've done it, you know, people who were paying for news to tell us how much they were paying for their main news subscription. And then we compared that with the advertised price on the website, the full price. And what we found is on average, about 4 in 10, so getting on for half, said they were paying less than the full price. So essentially, there's a lot of discounting going on. We kind of know that anyway. But especially in countries like the US and the UK, and these are countries where publishers are trying to entice more people to sample and pay for news, and then, you know, hopefully at the end of those trial periods, lock people in at a more sustainable price or raise prices later. So these are some of the tactics. A lot of trials. A lot of those trials are going on for long periods of time to give people more of a chance. And we're certainly seeing that in our data. But again, it makes it harder. At the end of that trial period, we find a lot of people dropping off because that jump is just too high.
So there is no shortage of challenges for publishers around the world. And we have highlighted many of those in our chat today. Nick, I'd like to end by asking you if you think that there are some examples of approaches taken by some news organizations or any specific initiative that show there is a way to thrive and successfully meet these challenges and improve the relationship with audiences?
I think there are, and that's partly because there's a lot of uncertainty right now, a lot of changing audience behaviors, and I think moments of change offer market opportunities. And so we've already highlighted that sort of shift to more audience-focused reader revenue strategies, and that is clearly working for a number of the sort of really big upmarket titles that are catering to sort of richer, more educated groups of people who are prepared to pay. So that's sort of one sector where we can point to a number of publishers that are actually doing quite well, quite profitable, investing in journalism again, but also niches, actually. Again, this is an opportunity to reach particular groups of people and provide distinctive value. So I think at both ends of the scale, we're seeing opportunities and many examples of successful media companies. I think other areas to look are where you see change. So that move to video, I think, is offering opportunities to create content that resonates with different kinds of audiences that maybe haven't been very well served by traditional media. So I talked about younger creators, but we're also seeing traditional media companies, public service broadcasters, really connecting in new ways using different kinds of digital formats. So I think that's a real opportunity and a real bright spot as well. And then we haven't talked about it so much, but actually some of those uses of AI to create more relevance and connect and to do it more cheaply than we've been able to do before. So I think often we don't think about the positives, but I think they are definitely there.
Thanks, Nick. Rasmus, to close, you've talked in the past about evidence-based reason for optimism. And indeed, even in our chat today, you've drew attention to the positive aspects alongside the challenges. Can you give us, in closing, what are your evidence-based reasons for optimism this year, if you see them?
Sure. Of course, we need to think about optimism for whom. And I think it's important here probably to distinguish between the public's perspective and then journalism as a profession and publishers as an industry. It's a very fraught media environment these days, a very challenging information ecosystem in many different ways. But I do think we need to recognize that people generally aren't that unhappy with it. It's not that people can't go direct to websites or pick up a print newspaper or revert to linear scheduled broadcasting on TV or radio instead of the digital media that they use and the platforms they rely on. It's not that they can't, it's that they don't. And even when it comes to news, this year we asked the set of user needs questions that Nick mentioned. And when we look at the sort of negative responses around that, the percentage of people who say they feel the news does a bad job of some of these key things, keeping people up to date, helping them learn more about topics and events, providing a range of different perspectives on topical issues, it's actually a very small minority of the public in most countries that are actively unhappy with the news that they get in this environment. Often only about 1 in 10 or in some cases even fewer that are unhappy with the news that they get. I think that Lea Korsgaard, the publisher of the digital newspaper Zetland in Denmark, have put it quite well when she said that people don't miss journalism. But journalism misses people, right? And this, of course, is the second part of the equation, is that from the point of view of publishers, there is no value in sugarcoating the message here. This is a supremely challenging environment. Very, very hard competition for attention, even harder competition for advertising and for earning the right to hope for payment from people or donations from people for one's work. That said, as Nick highlighted, there are a few publishers who are doing well in this few winners, many losers market. Some of them are legacy institutions, often doing the kinds of journalism that many reporters really value. Others are new entrants. Again, they are often like really respected and inspirational titles. We see some really creative and encouraging uses of the affordances of platforms by individual creators that, yes, are threats in a competitive sense, but perhaps also could serve as source of inspiration for publishers and journalists who really want to reconnect with people where they actually are, rather than insist that they must come to the legacy platforms that happen to be most lucrative for publishers. At a most basic level, from the point of view of journalism as a profession rather than publishing as an industry, I would say that there are reasons for optimism in recognizing again this year that what much of the public say that they want from news is what many journalists would like to be able to offer. It is factually accurate reporting. It is fair reporting. It is reporting that is independent from undue commercial political influence, free from bias. It is reporting that keeps people up to date, help them understand issues beyond personal experience, and help them recognize a range of different perspectives unlike their own. These are things that I think many journalists would like to offer the public. And in that sense, there is an appetite for some of the core principle values, basic things that journalists would like to offer. And the challenge, of course, then is how to deliver on that desire. But this is much better than a world in which people just didn't care. People would like to have this kind of journalism. And the challenge, of course, is how to deliver it by meeting them where they are culturally and concretely.
Thank you so much, Rasmus and Nick, for joining us today for our podcast.
Thanks for having us, Federica.
Thanks.
Our guests today were Nick Newman, lead author of the Digital News Report, and Rasmus Nielsen, co-author of the report and director of the Reuters Institute. Thank you all for listening to these episodes of the Digital News Report 2024 podcast series. Later in the series, we'll take a deeper look at some of the issues we talk about today, as well as other key themes of the report, including generative AI, reader revenue, trusted news, and much more. Look out for more episodes coming soon on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And if you don't want to miss any news from the Institute, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter by clicking the link on our X bio or through our homepage. This was Future of Journalism, a podcast by the Reuters Institute. I'm Federica Cherubini, and we'll be back soon.